Think of the soldiers who fought for Britain and the Allies in the Second World War, and you might think of young lads from Morecambe or officers who attended Sandhurst. You might not be thinking about someone from the coast of East Africa who speaks Swahili, or a Hindustani-speaking person from the country now recognised as India. We're now starting to recognise the war as a multiracial, multi-ethnic global conflict with global legacies. Its combatants from Britain's imperial possessions in Africa and Asia, referred to as colonial troops, were called upon to meet the rapidly expanding needs of the war, but their stories don't often feature in our broad understanding of the conflict. I'm Chloe Lee, a migration and citizenship researcher at the National Archives. I also host our podcast, On the Record at the National Archives, uncovering the past through stories of everyday people. In this episode of On the Record, I want to dig into a collection of records held at the archives that are connected to the experiences of these colonial troops. We hold thousands of papers from this history, from speeches of the British generals speaking in Hindustani to bilingual phrasebooks, and from propaganda magazines to powerful artworks that were intended to make fighting for the empire look like the only moral choice. As we approach the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in 2025, historians here at Kew have started to explore this history in new ways. This includes looking through the multitude of languages through which colonial troops participated in the war, and bringing some of those languages to life in audio dramas, which you'll hear throughout this episode. Before we start properly, I want to give a content warning. Some of these stories are about colonial violence and its legacy. They can make us feel distressed, sad, and angry. They're not always easy to listen to, but they're really important in our understanding of the past. I want to start this episode by speaking to Iqbal Singh, who is the Regional Community Partnerships Manager at the National Archives, and a specialist in colonial soldiers, seamen, and workers, and the imperial state. Iqbal is one of the historians who is deeply involved in our collection of records about South Asia and the First and Second World Wars. I wanted to find out more about his connection to the collection. Welcome, Iqbal. Welcome to the studio. I'm really looking forward to talking to you for On the Record. What do you do when you come into the National Archives? What does a day look like?
Very people-centred. I'm very lucky. I'm part of the outreach team. It's very public engagement focused. It's very much about applied work as opposed to sort of that pure work of just looking at records. You know, the research is key to my work, but it's about how you then apply that research in the kind of public sphere.
That's really interesting. And has there been a record recently that has really jumped out for you?
Well, I mean, the record that's really jumped out for me is the Tuka record. It's the record of Tuka's speech to the Indian troops that's been written out in a romanized Hindustani.
And where does that sit within our collection? Can you remind me?
That's a War Office record. And the collection that it comes from is a rich collection of sort of, you know, sometimes little notes and diary notes from officers about what's going on. Sometimes you've got these speeches, you've got appendices that can sometimes be very technical. And so this speech sits within that. And it's an extraordinary speech.
And are we early or later in the war?
We're about 1942. Okay. The Indian troops have now arrived in Africa. And they're part of this kind of Commonwealth effort to defeat the Axis powers and the Germans, basically in North Africa. And so Tuka is preparing a speech to rally the men, as it were. And it's got a kind of Shakespearean quality to it, but written out in this kind of Hindustani, but it's in a romanized script.
He has to address his Indian troops before the battle in Hindustani. He needs the help of a translator.
Tonight, forward elements of the 4th Indian Division
aaj raat ko
go to war.
4th Division ki aage wali faujein ladai mein shamil hoti hain.
Surrender is shameful as long as we have strength to bear
jab
our
arms. Tak hame hathiyar uthane ki taakat hai, qaid hona badi sharam ki baat.
And so when you read that speech, how did that feel?
Well, I mean, I was deeply moved because it reminded me of my own childhood growing up speaking Urdu in my own family house. And parts of that are kind of split off when you kind of go into school and workplaces where people kind of only see you as somebody who speaks English. And so kind of having that private moment was actually really important for me because it suddenly reconnected me with my childhood, and both my parents sang ghazals and sort of Indian songs, for use of a better term. And the poetry was really important. And the language that was used in that speech, because it was written in this kind of high register, it was written in quite a flowery text. It kind of reminded me of the poetry that we would sing at home. So some of the words had that kind of poetic quality to them. So yeah, there was an emotional moment. I thought very much about my parents. And even now I can kind of slightly feel that welling up.
And there's something that sits along there, like the official state archive, the recorded archive, and then what sits in our own personal archive. Yeah. And how they jostle up against each other and shape each other, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. And there was that jostling up completely. I mean, you know, the tear did well up and the memory comes quite quickly, you know, to think about my parents, the singing, how they met on the ship coming here. And Urdu and Hindustani was the language that they used. It was their lingua franca. My mother's a Sikh. My father's a Muslim. They were coming on a boat here in 1960. The thing that was their common bit, amongst a number of other things, but there were cultural commonalities, was language. And this shared language, the language of Bollywood as well. It's the language that North Indians certainly know very well.
It's so moving hearing about that, Iqbal. I can see it in my head, that, you know, moment of your parents meeting. What do you think they would have made of the work that you do every day?
Yeah, I think for them, it's been a very important journey seeing me grow into this role and this work. And drawing out these types of records and these connections, I think, would mean a huge amount to them. Because for them, as poetry, literature, this kind of language that they shared and loved, you know, just knowing that, you know, you're still engaged with it, and that inheritance, that legacy hasn't just been squandered, but that you're making something of it, you're trying to make a connection with it. And for me, as I say, I'm very privileged in the position I'm in, the ability to then put a platform out and allow others to also share in those conversations about those mother tongues, those split off sets of our identities, those other things that we might, you know, remind us of our own parents, but kind of using your own story as a way of doing that. And language, as I say, is such an important sensibility, because if you don't teach a child, you know, for example, quote unquote, the mother tongue, the child, you know, does miss out on something quite special if, you know, the parents came from somewhere else and that child can't connect with that, because language is often the window, the vehicle through which you make those connections.
It's not often you get to hear a historian like Iqbal having such a personal response to an archival record. So I'm really grateful for him sharing his stories with us. Like Iqbal, I was intrigued by these colonial troops' records, and I wanted to know more. I invited Iqbal back, this time with his colleague, Liz Haynes, to tell me more about the history of the colonial troops. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Chloe.
I want to kind of understand the role of colonial troops in Britain's history, and I guess specifically we're looking at the Second World War. Liz, can you tell me a bit more about their role?
Sure. I mean, I think the main thing to understand is that they were absolutely essential to the outcome of the Second World War, that the troops that fought on the side of the Allies were absolutely indispensable to the outcome that transpired. But also just that it was on a scale which I think people often don't understand or aren't familiar with. So, for example, we're looking today at soldiers from South Asia, or undivided India as it was, and East Africa. There were between 2.5 to 3.3 million, depending on different estimates, soldiers who fought from vast numbers just from South Asia, and about 250,000 from East Africa, which is, and so, for example, that's about 20% of the adult male population of Kenya who were fighting in the Second World War.
So 1 in 5.
1 in 5 adult men. Those numbers and that kind of quantity of people was obviously hugely important in terms of, you know, actual kind of combat. In parallel, the colonies were also a really important resource, like in terms of natural resources for making equipment, for keeping people fed. So the colonies were also a site of huge importance in that sense. So there was tension between people who were being enrolled as soldiers and the kind of the need to maintain local economies. But the numbers of people who are engaged in fighting and supporting fighting in all kinds of different roles, I think is one of the things that we really need to recognise about that period.
It's really interesting because those kind of numbers, when we're thinking about our role as historians, the amount of stories there, that's what's so intriguing to me. And when we're starting that journey, maybe some of us are starting that journey, I know you and Iqbal are both very invested in that already. What should guide us?
So I think, yeah, first of all, you're right, it's the stories of millions of people. And thinking about, for example, South Asia and East Africa, that's more than the number of people who served from the UK. So, you know, that's a really large in relation to the kind of numbers of British people who were involved in fighting. But I think also there's all of those personal stories. But I think one of the things that is really important to understand is that those soldiers were coming from societies. They were living as colonial subjects, not as citizens, but they were living under colonial administration in ways that disadvantaged them and in some cases actively oppressed them in complicated ways. So those people who were signing up, some people signed up. Technically, there was no conscription, but we also have lots of stories of people who were kind of forcibly enrolled or enlisted against their will. But those people who joined up were engaged in a conflict that didn't have anything like the same kind of significance or meaning for them as maybe for people in the UK. They weren't defending a way of life that was their own. They were defending a society that was exploiting them. So
it's very complicated to try and understand that and the motivations behind that, right?
Absolutely. And I think if you're, again, thinking about that broader colonial context, in all around what was the British Empire at that time, there were lots of struggles for independence and kind of nationalist movements. There was kind of active anti-colonial struggle in the context of unified India, of South Asia. That was very, very developed by that point. To the point where people were favouring the Japanese as potentially a kind of allies. People were signing up to fight with the Japanese against the allies. People from South Asians were to do that.
With the kind of future possibility that they might support their own
liberation from British rule. And again, thinking about the East African context, the future leader of the first prime minister and future leader of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, was in the UK at that time. And very much engaged in kind of Pan-African kind of anti-colonial politics, and again amongst lots of Pan-Africanists, there was resistance to this idea of the war and the idea of serving an empire that wasn't offering them rights and was slow to respond to their demands for equality and for freedom.
If I can pick up on what Liz has said, and I think it's important that Liz has given us a good background there, but I think one thing that I really do want to also emphasise, and I think it's a point that you've raised, is the complexity of what's going on. So the motivations of the Indian troops, for example, are both, you know, driven by elements of dissent, but also extraordinary levels of loyalty, and it's how that loyalty is fostered. And so in that sense, you know, the technical term is the subaltern, but the kind of the soldier who's basically somebody who's paid to do a job. They're not, you know, senior, but how you bring them in and draw them in, they don't fit the kind of model of, say, you know, the nationalist voices that are kind of anti-British. There's a lot of them who are invested. They're invested in this war. They're kind of a different kind of subaltern.
So when was this all happening? I know we're in the Second World War, but if you can maybe give a little bit of context as to when we're talking and why?
I mean, I think the thing to understand is in 1939, India enters the war, not with the permission of the Indian leadership. So it's already creating a huge amount of tension amongst the Indian political leadership of the form of Indian National Congress. So there's already, their backs are up. But the army has got a long tradition in India of working and offering opportunities. The First World War had seen men who served and then gained land. They gained, you know, status, credibility. So the army certainly had a pull. And so in many ways, once the war really starts to kick off, and from the 40s onwards, and so the early 40s, I should say, and then the entry of Japan in 42 with the kinds of defeats it then imposes on Britain, it creates a need to expand the army at exponential rates. And that, I think, is really important to hold on to, because the army changes from something that's in the hundreds of thousands in India's story to in the millions, as Liz has referred to. And taking that kind of manpower and managing it places all kinds of challenges.
Liz, can you talk to me a little bit about this drive across the Commonwealth to recruit and what that looked like, and what was driving British generals and politicians to think of colonial troops?
At the outset of the war, it wasn't really a huge priority for the British. I think some established areas like the British Indian Army were, you know, it was seen that they were established,
yeah,
that they were going to be involved. But it was really sort of through the war, and particularly with the war turning and the involvement of Japan, that the kind of numbers of fronts on which the Allies were fighting, and the kind of change in the nature of warfare, because they were fighting in different environments. So fighting, for example, in Burma in jungle environments, the nature of warfare and the scale of the number of fronts that were being managed shifted
from a European, maybe something that we're more familiar with, European fronts, to a global conflict.
Yeah, earlier in the war, they'd already been fighting in North Africa and East Africa, but they were environments in which the British and the Allies were more familiar in kind of encountering. But particularly, I guess, in Southeast Asia, that was a really different kind of terrain. But more importantly, it was really about the kind of the scale of the front that was opening and maintaining against the Japanese, who were a really formidable army. Maintaining the line. So the Japanese had advanced all the way through Southeast Asia by that point and were on the boundaries of India. So they were right at the kind of doorstep. So I think that changed both the kind of ideas about resourcing, but also about manpower, what was needed to maintain a kind of active resistance against an army that the Japanese in particular, that had suddenly really become much more of a threat than had been anticipated.
So it wasn't much of a priority, say, 1939, apart from maybe established groups, British Indian Army we've talked about. How did the British recruit and strategize to retain those colonial troops?
This is, I think, the key thing. Our records help to kind of feed into this, because a lot of the records that we hold are related to propaganda. They're related to trying to keep people basically on side, to get people to do what you need them to do. And so whether it's a propaganda report, looking at morale is a really important thing. They're constantly looking at the morale of the troops. What things can we do to help these troops fight for us?
And Liz, what collection is kind of these propaganda records kept in?
So we see them in different places. So we see some discussion, particularly around these discussions around morale and how the soldiers were feeling. They gathered this information from reading their letters home, from kind of censorship. So they had this idea of how people were feeling about things. But also we see them in the Colonial Office. So at that point, the War Office is responsible for kind of coordinating the military effort. The Colonial Office is responsible for mediating the British Empire and the British government and kind of managing British colonial administration. So they are interested in both the experiences of the soldier, the challenges of recruiting soldiers, but also very much the relationship between soldiers and their families and wider civil society. So the Colonial Office records are really interesting in the way that we see that relationship, particularly between the soldiers, the military need and kind of demand, and the impact that that's having on wider civil society. So that's directly the soldiers' families, but also, you know, broader kind of social and economic issues.
I see. So these records are kept to keep a record of morale, which should inform the authorities about keeping on those soldiers. What does the propaganda look like?
Well, I mean, there's various things. I mean, we've got, you know, magazines which are being printed, for example, the Fauji Akbar magazine, which is basically, you know, crudely translated army newspaper, and it's written in different languages, and it's a way of basically giving a view of the war that will keep the troops positive. Because, you know, India's going through, certainly in India's case, in that mid-40s period, economically, there are lots of difficulties. There's, as I say, the victories that the Japanese are having. It's creating real concern around morale, generally. And so these types of activities are there to try and keep people up. And also recruitment. So this is the other thing to really take into mind, that kind of traditional recruitment that was occurring, certainly in the First World War, around the martial races. These are the Punjabis, those from that sort of northwestern areas of India. By the Second World War, recruitment opens up. So they're looking south, they're looking north, they're looking elsewhere.
And my assumption is then that their strategies at recruitment change. They have to change.
Well, recruitment, I mean, I think the thing is that you need to get the message out all over the country, basically. And so some of our records also speak to that. So we have, you know, some flyers, propaganda type material, again, that's sort of written in Marathi, in Telugu, in Tamil. I mean, I've never seen stuff like this. But in the Second World War, you're seeing these types of documents appearing in Gujarati. I mean, these are not the traditional sort of recruiting grounds for Indians. So it's not just about the troops, but keeping people on side as well. This is the other thing to just keep in mind is that for the army, this idea that the offensive spirit is not just about, you know, the military element of the training that's needed and the kind of weapon, but actually learning languages, learning how you communicate, those softer skills, they're also part of the kind of offensive armory that's now needed to really be taken seriously.
Yep. Yeah, that's really interesting, those idea of soft skills. And Liz, have you found that as well in your work?
Yeah. So I mean, thinking on in terms of kind of practical format, we've got posters, very kind of graphically designed posters. Similar in nature to the kind of, you know, propaganda you can imagine from the UK. There's lots of wartime propaganda that people might have be familiar with around.
Yeah, those very, yeah. Dig for Victory, things
exactly,
like that. Very evocative.
Yeah. So some of that is being designed and produced in London and sent out to East Africa, and some of it's being designed and produced locally. So alongside those kind of posters, which we see, which we have examples of in English and Swahili and in other African languages, we also have booklets. So we have we have booklets that kind of tell the story. What does a career of a soldier look like? What are the opportunities that open up? And we know that those booklets, which are basically kind of photo books, were also came alongside films. So they would be going around different parts of East Africa with a van, projecting films and kind of recruiting, calling people up, talking to audiences, talking to villages, explaining again through these kind of picture narratives, what could be expected, which was of course always the sort of glamorous point of view where people are getting lots to eat, they're getting to engage with kind of modern technology, that, you know, those kind of things.
Appealing to that social mobility.
Absolutely.
Aspect. Yeah. Because as you said before, these people are colonial subjects, they're not citizens.
Yeah. So at that time in East Africa, I mean, it would be different in different parts of India, but in East Africa, large parts of the population are still engaged in subsistence agriculture. Not that many people have salaries. So to have a wage, a salary,
that
is already...
That is going to come in monthly or however it's given out.
Exactly, is really important. And most of those salary opportunities are in domestic service or in really poorly paid jobs. The army's paying better than all of those. So I mean, in that sense, you know, recruitment has an obvious kind of
economical...
Yeah,
benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. But they're also kind of playing on that kind of wider idea of modernization and social advancement. So yeah, engagement with these questions of kind of learning languages, learning skills like being electrical technicians or mechanics, skills which would potentially lead to more gainful, more profitable employment and social mobility after the war.
Yeah, and we see that in the propaganda. What I've looked at, those big posters. Can you maybe describe one of those for us, Iqbal?
I'm really interested to bring into this is also this thing about the language again, just to pick up on Liz's point. Language is really, really important in all of what's going on. And so what the British, certainly in India, are picking up on is that we've expanded the army exponentially. Officers are coming in who have got no real background in India because, you know, pre the war, you know, there was a much longer process in which you learned the language, you learned how to work with your troops, your Indian troops. Suddenly British officers are kind of literally being helicoptered in, as it were, and brought in to the field of battle and have to learn language on the job, basically. So these romanized scripts are not just the speeches, but also kind of like, you know, we've got one of our records is an anti-tank gun manual. And it's kind of giving basic instructions about how you look after that kind of operation. And so literally words are translated sometimes in quite sort of funny ways to try and describe elements of, you know, an anti-tank technical activity that you've got to take part in. And so I think that language element is really, really important to keep in mind.
And then you've got a, you know, an officer talking to you in your own language, evoking these big ideas, big concepts. I can see how that would be very persuasive.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Indian troops in particular, it wasn't the kind of traditional ways in which they were motivated, say, for example, patriotism or nationalism in that way. It was often they were very aligned to their regiment, to their officer, possibly, and also to their sense of duty.
And is that evoked in the speech?
And that's evoked in the speech.
I see.
So certain words like farz, which is duty. And the other thing that often was driving people was the economic side. People, you know, applied because it was a volunteer army. They didn't need to conscript because India has a huge population and there was a lot of rural poverty. People were willing to, you know, apply and get those jobs. And this idea of qarz, which is the other word, which is debt. You pay your debts. So farz and qarz are kind of like these tram lines along which many Indian lives were being led. And so in many ways, it's very interesting how those kind of concepts are being evoked in this speech.
There is a debt.
Sir, can I suggest a substitution? The word qarz or debt be substituted by farz or duty?
Two tram lines binding us. Qarz, farz, debt, duty. The British used gentlemanly Hindustani to train and command the troops. The 2.5 million men who learn to fight a war that is not theirs.
Yeah, and I mean, duty we talk a lot about in, you know, when we're having discussions about Second World War and contributions of soldiers that we might more traditionally assume to be associated with conflict. But debt, that sits quite uncomfortably with me. Can you kind of speak a bit more to that when you speak about debt in this colonial context?
Well, in the context of people having to earn a living and, you know, whether you were, you know, subject to a moneylender or you needed to make ends meet because, you know, your crop didn't do well. There's all those kinds of drivers that are leading people to find this type of work.
And fight in this war.
And fight in the war, absolutely.
And, you know, at this time, India is still a colonial possession.
India is still a colonial possession. And, I mean, the other big thing to understand is that by 1942, the Quit India movement has taken off big time. So Gandhi and the Nationalists, the Indian National Congress.
And this speech is 42.
So this is 42 as well. So it's all in that kind of same period when Indian nationalism is at a height. The Indian National Congress, which was the largest political party in India, were basically extremely upset that India had been brought into the war without Indian leaders being consulted.
Liz, maybe if I can bring you in there. What are the differences then between, you know, we've heard from Iqbal about propaganda in the Indian context. What about the East African context?
Sure. And I think I need to preface that by saying that I'm a white British person who doesn't speak Kiswahili. So I don't have the same access to the language at all, but particularly the kind of nuances of language that Iqbal does when he's working with these records. I rely on other people's kind of interpretation of them and engagement with them. So I don't have this quite the same or anything like the same level of subtlety in my reading of them, I guess. But I would say that from looking at the types of propaganda that we can see in relation to East Africa, the focus is, I think, less nuanced, more directed at that question of prestige and status and modernization. It's more focused on what the war might do for individuals within society. And I think, again, thinking about that relationship between the soldiers as individuals, their families and kind of communities, it's also about justifying the sacrifice or the role of the soldiers in that kind of colonial endeavor. So it's about making it look glamorous. It's about modernization. It's about personal gain, but it's also trying to kind of make sense of those soldiers in engagement and injury and death within a kind of broader picture of what colonial modernity might look like as well, I guess.
It's really interesting and it's so nuanced. Can you maybe describe then the challenges to understanding these records? It'd be great to hear from both of you on that.
I think certainly for me, one of the big challenges of looking at the language records was underneath that, looking at a Hindustani record are many of the sectarian and communal tensions that sit beneath, both at that time and post-war as well, that kind of Hindi-Urdu tension that exists. How do you put Hindustani in its context? When you're reading a Hindustani text, it's often referred to as Urdu. Urdu has largely become associated with Muslims in India. And so I think trying to understand the record and how you place it in its context and how people would have received it, who would have received it. And also it's written in a, as I say, in quite a flowery register. How would, just for a large amount of men, they would have been illiterate. So they would have certainly had a language they spoke, but some of the words that are being used would have gone way over their heads, and some of the phrases as well. So, I mean, it's trying to understand how was it received, and then also how was it read out? These officers,
yeah, and it shows the diversity of recruitment at that level. And I think it's really important to say here as well that there are other parts of empire where propaganda is disseminated, and you know we're talking about these specific contexts today. Liz, and I know you've kind of touched on maybe some of the complexities of doing this when you're a historian, bringing your own, bringing or not bringing that kind of lived experience or kind of something that you can touch into in terms of your own personal history. But there must be challenges in this work when we think about the racist attitudes towards troops.
Absolutely. You're reading statements which are explicitly racist. So, for example, if you're reading the censored letters, so you're reading extracts from censored letters. So soldiers who are writing home, talking about their personal lives, talking about their hopes, their dreams. You're seeing them kind of ripped out of the context of the letters that they've written to their families and being instrumentalized to try and work out, you know, what they need to do slightly differently in order to make sure that everyone keeps fighting. So, for example, you see stories of people who have requested leave and been to go home to a family funeral and not had the permission granted in time, or various other kinds of personal tragedies unfolding, but within the kind of not only the machinery of military might and kind of the force of the Allies, but also in interpreted and framed in very racist ways. So that in itself is challenging. I think one of the things which is hardest to read, and it's sometimes hard to even know how to present it to people, is one of the training manuals for Kiswahili that I've been looking at, where the language is a language book. It's a language learning book. It's like a textbook.
So it's a how
to. It's how to speak Swahili. So it's sort of like, you know, it's got the grammar broken down. It's got exercises. It's like anything that you might find in school.
And this would be distributed to soldiers themselves?
To soldiers themselves and the officers. But what they're being asked to translate is fundamentally, our ideas. So they're kind of key phrases or stock phrases that white British people would have been using in East Africa at the time. So they're and of course then the way that they're talking about Africans and what's being invoked as an idea of the African through this language training is very brutally racist. So
you've got this like co-option of language, but then you've also kind of got this doubling down of racist stereotype that is literally being spoken out, spoken through, spoken to.
Yeah.
People fighting on the behalf of Britain in the war, yeah, who have volunteered to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've heard a little bit about the challenges of those records, you know, really kind of also very personal, emotional challenges, I think. What are the opportunities in bringing these records out of the archives?
So we'd found a selection of records, and how we started out was just by inviting people to come and look at them and think through them with us. So we invited producer Finn Kennedy, and he in turn invited two writers, Ariane Zaramba and Shamala Chauhan, who have their own relationships with the two regions in question, their own kind of heritage and relationships to them. They came and sat and looked at the records with us, and that was the starting point for their creative process.
I mean, for me, the opportunity, and we've worked with audio drama before, but with this particular project, audio seems such a powerful way to enter what I am framing as the psychological worlds in which these stories that we're uncovering in the records need to kind of be processed. There's a world there, a sort of psychological world that the records draw out. Things that are going on in people's heads in terms of whether they're having to kind of speak out a speech that is in a language that they don't have any clue of, really, or how it's being received, how they're being trained to do that, but also the people who then, like ourselves and my generation, the generations that follow, thinking about how we then receive that information. There's a lot going on in our heads, and audio drama is very powerful in getting us to think about that kind of psychological world. So I think for me, that's where the opportunities have really come.
My heart was split in two. My words no longer flowed, connecting my people together. Instead, they spoke in different ways, creating a difference where before there had been connection. And yet, sometimes on a breeze, I hear the words across the split lines. Tongues and hearts cannot forget so easily.
And Liz has touched on this idea that we do have kind of extracts of voices and letters, but this opportunity of audio drama allows us to speak back to the record, perhaps. Liz, how do you feel about exploring the records in this way?
I think it's really powerful. So in this context, what we have are a lot of records which are very dry. We have kind of, as Iqbal's mentioned, kind of training manuals. We have language training manuals. We've got these sort of reports. We don't really have anything but tiny fragments of personal stories. And it's very difficult, or I think it's impossible, to understand what any of this means without thinking about it through the lens of someone who went through it. And I guess in this context, you know, we talk a lot about kind of revoicing or giving voice or kind of opening up the kind
unearthing
or, yeah. or finding ways for voices which have been silenced to kind of come to bring them back or to try to engage with them. And I think for me, what I love about the idea of audio drama in this context is that it sort of opens up the palettes of how we hear English or other languages spoken. I mean, if we imagine the kind of audio world of the 1940s, it brings so much depth and richness
to
how we understand the sound of the Second World War.
Yeah. And off that, so how did you direct the writers and makers of what is a huge task, really?
I mean, the brief was very broad. And I think whilst we're referring to them as audio dramas, I think they're more an audio experience. And I think both writers, each in their own way, have really worked with the sound engineer in amazing ways to create these qualities to their work. I think that's something that's, you know, been quite, you know, unprecedented in the work that I've done over many years in audio drama. Using the records, this particular experience has been quite a standout.
I'd love to speak to one of these writers, so I'm going to ask Shamila to join me in the studio. Shamila Chauhan, welcome to the studio. Welcome to the National Archives. Thanks for joining me today. Can you say a few words about yourself and your work?
I'm a playwright and screenwriter. I write a lot about women and the South Asian diaspora. And I'm really interested in power, gender, and sexuality.
That's great. So interesting. And can you tell me a bit about writing with records alongside and that moment when you looked at the records?
I was really interested in the project because it was a topic that I don't really engage with very much in my own work. So war, violence, anything like that are things that I really try to avoid and steer clear of. But I was really interested in it because I have worked with the archives before and found it really interesting to kind of find a story within loads of kind of seemingly impersonal records. And I had a good feeling that there would be some story that I could unearth that hadn't already been told.
And was there one particular record that stood out to you in that initial process?
Yeah, so when I went into the room, it's always like a lovely space. It's always quiet and you can like smell the paper. And there was this big book of posters, and they looked like these glamorous 1950s kind of, although they were made in the 40s, I guess, but that kind of really high glamour kind of artwork, really beautiful.
Very graphic. Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about, the INF.
Yeah.
Big books, big damn books.
And like the colours, though, so striking and vivid. But then when I looked at them, I could see that a lot of them were written with sort of Indian script. So kind of there were some in Gujarati, some in what would now be Hindi or Urdu. And I was really interested in that idea because I had expected them to be in English. And my understanding of Hindustani is not amazing, but I could definitely pick out specific words that were very sort of poignant and poetic. I could tell it wasn't like a straight, formal type of speech. They had really gone for the poetry and the kind of real depth of emotion in the way that speech was written in Hindustani. And that's the thing that blew my mind. I was like, oh, this speech is a big moment and could really illustrate the kind of bigger themes around empire and the way that they related to their Indian troops.
It's interesting you said about women being a lens through which you used to write your plays. And you use a woman as your main speaker for Hindustani. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
I mean, I guess being in the diaspora, one thing that's really stuck in my mind is the idea of Mother India. And there was a massive film way back when called Mother India, which really sort of stayed with me. But the idea of a country being kind of gendered as a woman is really interesting because India has a massive, well, the kind of the Hindu side of India has a massive history around goddesses and venerating women in that way. Obviously, politically and on the ground, it doesn't always translate, but there is this ideology around womanhood and power and Shakti, which I really kind of relate to and find a very powerful thing in my own writing and in myself. And so I was really interested in the idea of this woman representing Hindustani. And then later on in the piece, because we do look at partition, kind of a female protagonist worked really well with the idea of birthing these two nations, as it were.
And something that's so moving when we're listening to these plays is that use of sound. Can you speak a bit more about the use of sound and how that, you know, how you wanted to curate that almost?
The sound was really fun because I got a chance to be quite playful and you can move from a kind of surreal, magical place, which is kind of where the story sort of begins and this kind of birth of this kind of surreal being of Hindustani. And there's like Farooq, who did the sound engineering, really did some beautiful things in terms of using different instruments from different parts of sort of undivided India and kind of trying to create a resonance and a kind of continuity of sound through the whole piece, which that was all his magic.
My siblings call me the favorite. Favored by our parents, loved by the people. I was the special one.
But what I was really able to do with the text was be free to travel. So from real kind of real places, real events, kind of, you know, the college, the kind of the training of the army, all of that, and then also going to these like really surreal metaphorical spaces really easily with sound.
Yeah, and that's so effective with the use of water throughout that the play.
Yeah, and again, that's a kind of a thing that people really resonate with, this idea of these two rivers that have come from different places communing and in this one place, which I felt really embodied the whole idea of language and how language is formed and how language then also continues. It is always difficult because you're seeing, you know what you're reading is from a particular lens and it's a kind of dispassionate lens anyway at best because it is governmental kind of official records. And often they are devoid of kind of, as a writer, you're always looking for the human, the personal, the kind of story beneath the story. So in that way, it's tough. It's also very, very tough and confronting as a diasporic South Asian person to kind of look at things that, you know, somewhere your ancestors were affected by, and we are not able to kind of engage in that history in any other way, in a way, in the diaspora. I'd have to go back to India. And even then, I think a lot of the records obviously are all from a colonial perspective. So it's kind of trying to work with what's there and then go deeper and sort of, in a way, for me, channel what is already in myself as a way to create something new with it.
Thank you, Shamila. You've given us so much to think about. And I think it's really interesting as a listener to get that extra kind of heart and intent behind what you've created. For me, it enhances our understanding of these records and it informs, I guess, a wider sense of how history in the archive is so much broader when we look above and how art has such a significant and moving role in that. So thank you for bringing that for us today.
Thank you for having me.
The clips you've heard throughout this episode came from the audio dramas produced by Applied Stories for the National Archives. You can listen to the dramas in full on SoundCloud. We'll link to them in the episode notes, along with other audio drama commissioned by the National Archives. Thanks for listening to On the Record from the National Archives. To find out more about the National Archives, follow the link from the episode description in your podcast listening app. Visit nationalarchives.gov.uk to subscribe to On the Record at the National Archives so you don't miss new episodes, which are released throughout the year. Listeners, we need your help to make this podcast better. We need to know a bit more about you and what themes you're interested in. You can share this information with us by visiting smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. That's smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. We'll include that link in the episode description and on our website. You can also share your feedback or suggestions for future series by emailing us at ontherecord@nationalarchives.gov.uk. Finally, thank you to all our experts who contributed to this episode. This episode was written, edited, and produced by Tash Walker and Adam Smith of Aunt Nell for the National Archives. This podcast from the National Archives is Crown copyright. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License. You'll hear from us soon,